Genesis 2, verses 1 to 3 is what we'll be looking at today.
Hooks this
because it is inseparably tied to the prior six-day section. I mean, this is day seven. It's another 24-hour day, just like the prior 6 days were. But this day also is nothing like the prior 6 days that were spelled out before us. And since March 27th, I looked on my calendar, Smed has been taking us through the gears of chapter 1, one day after another day. And God says it is good, and we shift into the next day. And then God says it is good, and we shift into the next day. And we just keep going, and it builds into a climax. And you finally get to day 6, and the image of God is filled out. And God doesn't say at the end of that day it's good. He says it's very good. We just race on to day 6. Well, in Genesis 2, 1-3, God turns off the creation engine. And he pulls the key out, and he pulls the barking back. Let me read verses 1-3. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. He rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Well, what is this passage all about? We're going to keep it simple this morning. It's just about his dramatic change of course. God's dramatic change of course in the creation narrative is on full display in the seventh day. And this is what hooks us. God is doing something completely different now on day 7. So what do we see? I'm going to give you the 2 points and we'll work through them one at a time. What we see is this, that God restricted his creating to 6 days. That's the first point. That's what's being made, the point being made in verses 1 and 2. But he did that, number 2, to reveal his pleasure on the seventh day. God restricted his creating to 6 days to reveal his pleasure on the seventh day. Let's just jump into number 1. God restricted his creating to 6 days. Verse 1 functions like a summary of all that has proceeded since Genesis 1:1. Verse 1 of chapter 2 says that after day 6, there is not one other new creature or portion of creation that will be created by God. Nothing is left to create. Notice, all their hosts are complete. All of the hosts that are associated with the heavens, all of the hosts that are associated with the earth, it's a beautiful picture of all the created things in both spheres of the heavens and the earth, all of them lined up under the leadership of God and man, who was supposed to exercise dominion on the earth. They're spoken of, all the things that fill the heavens and all the things that fill the earth, they're spoken of like they're lined up, like they're marshaled, they're well-disciplined, and they're under command. And how great the sum of this boundless host is, it's all of them. All the multitude of what inhabits and fills the heavens and the earth is completed. Not one of them is missing. God is thorough as a creator. He's careful. He's complete. And that is a striking thing to say at this point. Because for 6 days, God has been speaking things into existence. He spoke the heavens into existence. He spoke the earth into existence. And then the multitude of everything that inhabits those, he spoke into existence. And here in the Hebrew, chapter 2, verse 1, puts in the place of emphasis the word completed or finished. If we could see this like it actually is in the Hebrew, it would come across this way to you. And finished is everything. Finished! Done! All three verses make this overwhelming point. Verse 1, they were completed. Verse 2, God completed his work. Well, which work? Verse 2, the work which he had done. Verse 2, he rested. Verse 2, he rested from all his work which he had done. Verse 3, it says it again, he rested. He rested from what? All his work which God had created. That's an explosion of finished language from God. God's creating power was firing away as fast as he could pull the trigger for 6 days. And now day 7, he took his finger turned off the trigger, and he put his creating power into the holster. He's done. Notice verse 2. The end of that says, by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. I think the ESV says, on the seventh day, God completed the work that he had done. And that is a possible translation. But this does not mean that some of the creating spilled over into the seventh day. Like she's still firing some creating shots on day 7. Because 2:1 has already made it clear before mentioning the seventh day that the work was complete. So the best translation then will be the one that gives the sense that God's work is already completed by day 7. And then notice how verse 2 differs from verse 1. Look at it. In verse 1 spoke of the completion of creation in a passive way. The heavens and the earth were completed. The completing was done to them by somebody else who's not mentioned directly. And we all know that is God. That's the way of saying creation was completed without mentioning God directly. But now in verse 2, and even in verse 3, God is directly on display. Directly on display. He is the only actor visible. God completed, verse 2. God rested, verse 2. And then in verse 3, God blessed. And God sanctified because God rested. But this God rested, what does this mean? The word rested means God ceased from doing what he was doing. He stopped doing what he was doing. So, what had God been doing? Creating. He stopped creating. That's what's being said. In that sense, he rested from creating. He stopped creating anything new. This is not the rest of somebody who's weary, but this is the rest of one who has achieved his goal in creation. Here it is, are you ready? He stopped creating, and he was done. That's it. He was done. And again, the point is made that he stopped from all that he had created and made. This means that as man was walking about on day 7 on the earth, he could find no evidence anywhere of God's power of making new things. It was a day that was absent of a working creator, a creator applying his creating power. So, the heavens and earth were completed, God completed his work, which we had done. He stopped on the seventh day, he rested. Because then he blessed and sanctified, because then he rested and stopped. I wonder what the point is. It's kind of clear, isn't it? The point is that God restricted his creating power to 6 days. That was God's plan. That from day 7 on, this was his plan, from day 7 on, man would not be able to any longer see the Creator's creating power being applied. He wouldn't walk anywhere and all of a sudden, boom, something would be there that wasn't there before. Like it had been on for 6 days. That's right. From day 7 on, this says that the creative power that God applied on the earth for 6 days is no longer visible. It's no longer in action and it can't be visible. His creating power that made new things is not still at work on day 7 making new things. Is there evidence of a creator on day 7? Of course. His fingerprints are everywhere. But just because there is evidence of a creator doesn't mean that he's still creating. Look, my wife can be in the house baking for 6 hours, and then she stops. If I come into the house on the 7th hour, is there evidence that there was baking going on? Everywhere. But she's not baking. That's what's going on. There's evidence everywhere of a creator, but the evidence is not his creating power being applied to new creatures. And this is where evolutionists are so so off from God. The powers or the forces of nature that they see at work today, they claim are the same ones and the only powers or forces that were at work in the beginning of the earth. What processes they see going on today, they think are the same exact processes that were going on in the beginning. God is making it clear, though, in Genesis 2, 1-3, that there was a creating power that was at work for 6 days, and everything was formed by it. And now, since day 7, you can't see that creating power still being applied. You can't. Different powers from God, certainly, are being implemented in this world. This world under the curse of sin is disintegrating. It's crumbling. It's falling apart. And so God acts powerfully as sustainer. He's conserving this because all of his promises have to be fulfilled. That power is certainly being applied. But to assume that the disintegration force that this world is undergoing because of sin, and to assume that God's sustaining power, his conserving power, are the only powers, the same powers that started everything, is a huge blunder. Build a theory off of that foundation, and it crumbles before it even starts. And the only way we would know this is not by looking at the mountains or looking into the sea or looking into the stars. The only way we know this is by looking right here. Genesis 2. Now verse 3 tells us why God stopped the creating that he was doing. Number 2. God restricted his creating 6 days to reveal God's pleasure on the seventh day. Let me unpack verse 3 and I'll show you what I mean by God's pleasure on the seventh day. It says in verse 3, then God blessed the seventh day. That means God poured out his favor on the day. With everything done, God now just wants to pour out his favor on the whole condition of creation. His creating power is in the holster, and he is now unloading the clip of his blessing. It says that God sanctified it. He sanctified the seventh day. That means he set that day apart. Well, when you set something apart, you set it apart from something to something. What did he do? God set apart day 7 from the other 6 days. And he set it apart to himself. Think on this one. The first 6 days are perfect. They're perfect. Was there anything common or planned or blasé about everything coming into existence in this? Nothing was common about it. Everything was only uncommon, unique. Was there any taint of sin anywhere in day 1-6? No. Sin isn't anywhere to be found. So how did God view those uncommon days? Well, every time one of those days was done, he said, good. And on the last one, the 6 days, is very good. And so the way you can see those, God couldn't improve on those 6 days of creation. There was not a holier version of creating that he could have picked up and done. And yet, he says, day 7, set it apart from those for me. Something unique is going to happen on day 7. God stopped creating. That's why he's blessing. He stopped so he can bless. That's what's going to make this day different. All this means is that God's plan was to only create for a short period of time, and then the day following it would be special. That day would display God's favor. It would display God's blessing. It would display his sanctifying work in a way that the first 6 days weren't even designed to do. And that's staggering. Each prior day had no taint of sin on it. It only had God's holy fingerprints all over it. The day 7 can't be lumped in with those days. God's plan is to bless, to pour out his favor. It's his plan to sanctify, to put his blessing and his holiness on display when he was done creating. Not as he was creating, really, but when he was done. How do you make something perfect even more uncovered. So here's the perfect creator before his perfect creation. No sin anywhere. On this seventh day, no new creatures are coming into existence. But all of God's creatures are basking in God's favor, his blessing. Everything is experiencing his sanctification of all things. And I call that God's pleasure. God is very pleased on this day. Everything is under the banner of his pleasure. Everything is in the shade of his pleasure. Everything is sinking to the bottom of the deep end of the pool of God's pleasure on this day. And that is what God was aiming for. This was why the creating went the way that it did. This is why it only lasted 6 days, because day seven was on his mind. God's pleasure needs to shine on that day. I want to bring something to your attention. In chapter 1, verse 5, and there was evening and there was morning one day. Verse 8, there was evening and there was morning a second day. Verse 13, there was evening and there was morning a third day. Verse 19, there was evening and there was morning a fourth day. Verse 23, there was evening and there was morning a fifth day. Verse 31, and there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. That day stands out different from the first five. And then you might expect, at the end of verse 3, for it to end with the same formula. There was evening and there was morning, the seventh day. Why do you not see that formula at the end of this special day? Well, the text doesn't tell us. But you know what I think is very interesting? What I think is very interesting is that this formula ended when the creating ended. That formula appears to have been put away with God's creating power being put away by God. It would seem to me that those formulas then were used by God to help us see a division between his creating power process being applied at each 24-hour section of creation. So God desired his applied eternal power as creator to stand out exceptionally this way by marking the beginning of it and the end of it. Look at everything I did with my eternal power in that 24-hour period of time. You're not going to find any of this filling over that 24-hour period of time in the next one, because I've got eternal power being applied in that 24-hour spot. He intended to mark off his eternal creating power that way. So then, God's eternal power that creates new things, it gets put away on day seven, and so the formula is put away as well. Because the formula serves to accent the creating is there. There's no reason the flow of chapter 1, end of chapter 2, to all of a sudden call into question how long this seventh day is. It's just like my life. 24 hours. How did sinless Adam, sinless Eve, view this day? Yeah, well, this was their first full day. Day 7, right? How did they view it? Well, as they were in day 7, they obviously enjoyed God's pleasure on them like everything else did. His blessing and his sanctification of the day would have been a stunning thing to experience. It would have been an amazing day of worship. So then, what did sinless Adam and Eve do? And think about day 7 on day 8. What did they do? And think about day 7 on day 14. Look carefully at verses 23. Look carefully. The Bible doesn't say. Passage doesn't say what they did. Are you okay with that? It doesn't say. Genesis 2, 1 to 3 doesn't say anything about Adam or Eve. There's not a command anywhere in these three verses for Adam or for Eve to do anything. Genesis 2, 1 to 3 is all about God. you see the word Sabbath in there. It's not anywhere to be found. Yeah, the root of the noun Sabbath is there, and it's in the verb form to rest. Certainly. But what it's going to conclude is that day seven was designed by God to be something of a landmark day that put His blessing and His sanctifying pleasure on display. It certainly would have been a day you would never forget. I imagine it. I mean, even whatever day after day seven, saying, you remember that day? Do you remember how it stood out even beyond our first day? Day six? What an amazing day. I mean, even I was sitting there, I was giving names to all of these animals, and I'm like, I'm really tired, so I took a nap, and next thing I know, I woke up and there you were! And it was amazing! That day six was incredible, but remember day seven? It wasn't anything like that day. If God intended something specific for sinless Adam and Eve to do or think about this day on other days, God doesn't tell us about it here. And that is the hook. That's the hook. Because I want you to read. That's the hook. What does God's change of course in verses 1 to 3 lay the foundation for? Let's start making our way forward through the Bible. Something really important is going on here. It's so little that it's spelled out. So what do you have to do in that case? Read forward. If God wanted man to do anything special on this seventh day, what would God have to do? He'd have to tell them. Because what God is seen here doing four acts. God completed, God rested, God blessed, and God sanctified. If He wants man to do anything patterned off of that, He's going to have to say, all of the above. A, and never B, C, and D. B only, and sometimes D. He's going to have to spell it out for us because we don't know from this passage. You have to be content with what God revealed here in Genesis 2, 1 to 3. And you have to be content with what He did not reveal in 2, 1 to 3. So let's keep reading. How long before Adam and Eve sinned? We don't know exactly, but it appears that the perfection of everything didn't last very long. When Adam and Eve rebelled, death came into the world, sin was in the world, and everything began to disintegrate all around them and penetrated the world. And God then took, in Genesis chapter 3, verse 14, you can turn over there, God took then another dramatic change of course. In Genesis 2, 1 to 3, God is there blessing. It's almost like He sat down from His work of creating. He's just pouring His blessing out on creation. And you get to Genesis chapter 3 where there's sin, and God isn't blessing anymore. God is cursing. Verse 14, He curses the serpent who deceived Eve. And the God who blessed and sanctified everything is now saying to the woman that He told to multiply, multiply, fill the earth. Now God says, I'm going to multiply your pain. And He says to the man, I curse the ground now because of you. And the God who rested from creating appears to not be resting anymore. In fact, He appears to have sacrificed an animal in 3:21 so as to take His hide and to cover Adam and Eve from their shame and guilt. How could God rest any longer? With all of this going on in His creation, a horrible disease has infested everything. Every portion of creation is now groaning under the sin of them, under the curse. How can God bask in His own pleasure now, like He did on day seven? He can't. There is no getting back to day seven. It's a distant memory. There's only one thing for the Creator who rested to do now. And that is to take up the work of Redeemer. Take up the work of Redeemer. And that is what we see happening from Genesis 3 on. In my Bible, only about 3 pages are devoted to the work and the rest of the Creator. And all of the rest of it, all this big of the Redeemer and the rest that the Redeemer will provide through a new creation in Christ. As Creator, His rest was short-lived. As Redeemer, His rest will be full. It will be eternal, and those who enter into His rest will never have it taken away. It appears now that man isn't basking in the Creator's rest. Everything now has become hard and toilsome. In chapter 3, verse 17, then to Adam, God said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and you have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. You will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust. And to dust you shall return. That's an interesting thing to say to the image of God. You're dust. And God, in this, makes some kind of a mysterious promise in chapter 3, verse 15, that makes man, in all of his toil, start looking for an offspring to come. In chapter 3, verse 15, the Lord says to the serpent, I will put enmity between you, serpent, and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, between offspring. And he shall bruise you on the head, serpent, and you shall bruise him on the heel. There's going to be a battle. And the offspring of the woman will take a shot to the heel. The serpent gets clawed. Now go to Genesis chapter 5, verse 28. This is almost 900 years later. And a father has a bouncing baby boy on his lap. And Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. And now he called his name Noah, saying, this one will give us rest. This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. Do you know that at this point, Adam is still alive? He's got about 50 years to live. Do you think they knew about what happened in Genesis 3? This man is looking at his offspring saying, maybe you'll bring rest from this curse. Beyond this, in the pages of Genesis, what do we see? Well, go to chapter 8, verse 10. Noah is on the ark, and the waters have not yet subsided, and it says here that he waited another 7 days. And again, he sent out the dove from the ark, verse 12. Then he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, and she did not return to him again. It appears that man recognized the 7 day a week cycle. What is interesting is that there is nothing concerning the Sabbath for man through Genesis into Exodus chapter 16. It's strangely absent, the idea of the Sabbath. Oh, God did lead man to some very specific and very important religious duties. How did that be in Genesis? You see worship regulations in Genesis, like sacrifice. You see the importance of blood spelled out very clearly. You see a covenant regulation like circumcision, that made it to the pages of Scripture. You see a worship regulation like tithing. When Abraham offered someone to Melchizedek a tithe, you see that. But a worship regulation like the Sabbath rest didn't find its way onto the pages of Scripture from Adam all the way up to Israel in the wilderness. So let's turn to Israel in the wilderness. Go to Exodus 16. Turn there with me. Exodus 16, verse 22. Exodus primarily reveals God not as the Creator, but as the Redeemer. The Creator has become the Redeemer. He's become the Redeemer of a family nation called Israel. And the rest that the Creator enjoyed on day 7 is gone, remember? But in Exodus and following, the Redeemer now has rest that he wants to put in front of this nation he's redeeming. There's rest he wants them to enter into now. Let me read verses 22 to 34. Now on the sixth day, they gather twice as much bread. This is the manna. Two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath. There's the first mention of it in the Bible. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, put it aside and be kept until the morning. So they put it aside until the morning, as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it, because you know what happened on all the other days. If they tried to keep any from the day that they gathered to hold on to for the next day, it became foul. But God is now going to do something different. On the sixth day, he says, get twice as much, and on the seventh day, whatever is carried over, it won't become foul. Verse 25. Eat it today. For today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will find it. You will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. It came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather. They found none. And then the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Listen, I think Exodus 16 reveals how foreign the idea of a Sabbath day is. They don't get it. They need a special warning and admonition and instruction. A Sabbath day was not a common practice to them. They go, oh yeah, we get this. They had to be trained to get it. Go to Mount Sinai, Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle or your soldier who stays with you. Now watch what happens. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth. There is Genesis. The sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. There's Genesis 2. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day, and he made it holy. What is God doing as we move forward in the Bible? Now he's instructing man what to do with the Sabbath day. He wasn't doing that in 2, 1 to 3. God is now linking who he was as the creator who rested in Genesis 2. Now he's linking that with the people, the family nation that he is redeeming. As their redeemer, they will now have a day of rest that is associated with his day of rest as creator on day 7. Now what did that do for Israel? Think about where they are. They're on the plains of Moab. They're about to go over the promised land and take over the promised land. There are nations there with foreign gods. What does this do for them before they get there? It helped them to see that their God was not any one of the so-called gods of the Amorites, but he was Yahweh, who created everything in 6 days and then rested from creating on the seventh day. And every week it was a reminder to them that their God was a different God. The Sabbath rest became a central focal point of the covenant that God had with Israel. And this isn't all that God gave to them. There's an explosion of rest that comes from Exodus and Leviticus. The Sabbath day rest cycles went around every 7 days. It's like a small little wheel that spins fast. Every seventh day, the Sabbath came. Sabbath day. But then he also gave the 7 year Sabbath, right? That came about over 7 years. And then that rest wasn't a day, it was a whole year long. And then every 50th year, what? Another year of rest came, the year of Jubilee. Slaves were set free. If you sold your land and lost it, you got it back, your family. So every seventh day, God says, I'm going to put rest right in front of your face. Every 7 year, I'm going to put a year in front of your face, a year of rest. And every 50th, once in a lifetime, Israel, another year of rest. All kinds of layers of rest. And don't forget also that out of this nation, with rest everywhere in it, we are still to expect an offspring. A seed to come will be tied to God's rest for man. He's going to come from this family nation that has these smaller rests everywhere in the land. But that's not even all of the rest that God gave to them. Write these passages down. Deuteronomy 12, verses 8 to 10. And Deuteronomy 25, verse 19. And Joshua 11, 23. And Joshua 14, verse 15. God also ties the promised land to this rest language. So now, even when they look at the dirt before them, give rest. Give rest. Got mud on my sandals to get off. Rest. Now go forward to Psalm 95. Psalm 95, verse 6. King David, the man after God's own heart, he was very concerned for his people Israel. He was very concerned for this rest that God has for Israel. Now, the writer of Hebrews in the New Testament attributes the psalm to David in Hebrews 4, 7. We'll see that in a little bit. Let me read verses 6 to 11 for you. Come, let us worship and bow down, David says to those around him. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they have seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation, God says, and said they are a people who err in their hearts. They do not know my ways. Therefore I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter my rest. God swore in his anger, truly they shall not enter into my rest. God said something like this in Numbers 14 and in Deuteronomy 1. And he said that to challenge the Israelites, the first generation in the wilderness, in Moses' day. Now, centuries later, David is picking up the same words, and he's using them to exhort his contemporaries in his day, so that when they hear God's voice, they don't do the same thing that the first generation did in the wilderness. He doesn't want them to miss the call to rest. Now just tell them. Don't they already have rest? They've had the Sabbath day rest going on for a long time. They've got the 7th year Sabbath. They've got the year of Jubilee. How many 50-year periods of time have gone by? They're in the promised land under the greatest king, King David, who's a man after God's own heart. What rest is he worrying about that not entering into? What rest do they need to be afraid of missing? Sounds like they've got a pretty high dose of rest. God has a greater rest in mind, beyond Sabbath day rest, beyond 7th year rest, beyond land rest. Evidently, you could have the Sabbath day rest, you could have the 7th year rest, you could have the year of Jubilee rest, you could have the rest that the land provides, and not have the bigger rest that God has, that David is concerned about for his contemporaries. And remember, we're still looking for an offspring to come who is especially tied to this rest from God and is time to meet him. Matthew 11, verse 28. It is Jesus Christ. Matthew 11, verse 28. Moses could only warn his contemporaries about this rest. David could only warn his contemporaries about missing this rest. But here is the one who can do more than warn. Because he gives that rest. Verse 28, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest it is easy and my burden is light. Rest for your souls. This is that bigger rest that God always had in mind, that David was concerned his contemporaries were going to miss, even if they had the weekly Sabbath, even if they had the yearly Sabbaths, even if they had the land. Who cares if you have all of those smaller rests, but you fail to see or gain salvation rest, soul rest in Messiah? The Sabbath day couldn't touch rest for the soul like Messiah can touch soul rest. Only Messiah, who is that seed, who is that offspring, is the one who can touch the soul with the rest, the salvation rest it so desperately needs. They're going to the next chapter. At that time, Jesus went to the grain fields on the Sabbath. Messiah, the only one who can provide this rest for the soul, finds himself now in the smaller day of rest called the Sabbath in Israel. And the Pharisees don't like the way Messiah is treating their Sabbath day. So Messiah, Jesus, indicates what his relationship is to the Sabbath. Verse 6. I say to you that something greater than the temple is here. Sabbath day observance was tied to temple worship regulations. Look at verse 8. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. You see, the smaller day of rest known as the Sabbath, it can't compare to Messiah saying, come to me, and I'll give your soul rest. Come to me. That weekly Sabbath rest had to get on a knee and bow to the Lord of the Sabbath. And Paul knew this. Go to Colossians chapter 2. Paul knew this. Colossians 2, verse 16. Messiah, the Redeemer, he goes to work at the cross. Messiah works at the cross. And what did he say? It is Creator said, it's finished. The Redeemer says, it's finished. And Paul knew this, and he taught this very truth after Messiah had been crucified and been raised from the dead and ascended to the right hand of God. After detailing in chapter 2 here the life-transforming work of the cross and the lives of those who believe, Paul now makes it very clear that the Sabbath day regulation is over. Verse 16. He says to the believers, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. If anybody comes to you and tries to impose on you regulations about food and things like that or in the Sabbath day, let no one act as your judge on it. Things which are in your shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. No one wants the shadow, the Sabbath day, of the great Messiah when they can have Messiah and his soul rest. And this shadow imagery that is used by Paul here, it helps you understand the way that God wrote the Bible, his autobiography. In the Old Testament, you're reading, and all of a sudden, you know, you come across a very big and broad and thick shadow. Something big is looming. And you look as hard as you can, but you can't see what is casting the shadow yet. And so you keep reading, and you keep walking, and then you get to the New Testament, and it's Messiah. And his name is Jesus. He's casting the shadow. Listen, if a weary and burdened little child has to choose between sitting in daddy's shadow or sitting in daddy's lap, it's a no-brainer decision every single time. Why would you choose the shadow when you can have death? Why would you choose the Sabbath day when you can have the rest himself, Messiah? That's Paul's point. Let's go to Hebrews 3. Hebrews 3. The writer of Hebrews believes that the Christians he is writing to are in a very similar place that David's contemporaries were in his day. These Christians, they need the same kind of exhortation that David gave the Israelites on his day. As the Israelites on David's day were in danger of missing the great salvation rest of God, so this persecuted church needs to be careful to not miss Messiah's soul rest. Look at chapter 3, verse 6. We're talking about Messiah. He was a faithful son over his house. And then the believers were exhorted, hold fast our confidence in the boast of our hope firm until the end. And then he quotes Psalm 95. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart as when you go to me as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where our fathers tried me by testing me, and they saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their hearts, and they did not know my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter mine rest. The writer of Hebrews is picking up that same language and he's using it and he's applying it to the believers in his day. And he applies it in verse 12. Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God. But encourage one another day after day. As long as it is still called today. Where did he get that word? Psalm 95. When David said, today. Which came from the wilderness when God said, today, I've had it. As long as it is still called today, evidently every day still has the opportunity to be called today. Watch your heart. Verse 18 of chapter 3. To whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter the rest because of unbelief. And I drop down to chapter 4, verse 6. Verse 4, he mentions Genesis 2. God rested on the seventh day. Verse 6, therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, that rest, and those who formerly had good news preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience, he again fixes a certain day, today. Same truth, David, after so long a time, just as had been said before. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. From the wilderness to David, many days went by, but God said, today, don't miss it. Verse 8, if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. If Joshua's rest in the land was all the rest that God had in mind, there would be no reason to call the people to be concerned in Psalm 95. So what's the principle? With all of these other rests, verse 9, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Let me explain what the writer says. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works. I think that's the works of self-righteousness. You don't enter into Messiah's rest unless you cease your works righteousness. And so here we are in Hebrews 4, and we are tied all the way back to Genesis 2, because, verse 10, what is it? His rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. So therefore, let's be diligent to enter that rest so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. Evidently, believers of any era need exhortation in this matter to continue pursuing God's rest in Messiah. Now, why do we need to keep running after it? Is it because it's elusive? Is it a game of tag when we try to get it, it just slips away? No, it's not that way at all. God desires simply for us to not stroll across the finish line. It brings him glory that we are racing as fast as we can and we snap the tape and we come through into his ultimate rest. We don't cross that line when we're kicking a can down the road. God gets glory from us in racing after his salvation rest in Messiah. Break the tape. You can't miss this rest by missing a day, a year, a land. You miss it by disobeying Messiah. You miss it by disobeying, disbelieving Messiah. One last passage. Revelation 22. And you ought to be very comforted because I cannot turn to anything else after Revelation 22. And I promise that I won't turn to anything else after Revelation 22. Verse 1. As great as our current experience is of Messiah's rest that we have in this world on this side of heaven, there is an even greater experience of rest with God after this life. Write down Revelation 6:11. Don't turn there, but Revelation 6:11. The souls of those who were slain in the great tribulation are told to rest for a little while longer. Same thing is said in Revelation 14, verse 13. Now, Revelation 22, verse 1. This reflects something of the first pages of your Bible. You're going to see mentioned here a tree of life. And you're going to see that there is no curse anywhere at the first pages of your Bible. Verse 1. Then he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. But there's something here that's different than the first pages of the Bible. There's a lamb in the middle of the street. On either side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruits, yielding its fruits every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healings of the nations. There will no longer be any curse, and the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his bondservants will serve him, and they will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and there will no longer be any night, and they will have no need of the light of the lamp nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God will illumine them, and they will reign forever and ever. Listen, this place of rest where there is no curse, where there is a tree of life, this day is more than day seven. Because the Lamb and his throne are here, and they weren't there in day seven. Quite like this. The Creator introduced something to us in Genesis 2, something amazing. And the whole rest of the Bible was not trying to get us back into Genesis 2 into day 7, but it's been working to get us to this day. Eternal states, new heavens and a new earth, new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, was moving us forward to this day. Now I want to finish with six questions for you, and one of them you need to pick out for the day and meditate on. So here they all are up on the screen. One of these is meant for you. Have you acknowledged the curse of sin on you that keeps you from the Redeemer's soul rest? Or have you become weary and heavy laden as you live apart from Jesus Christ? Or have you accepted Jesus' invitation to himself and submitted your life under his lordship to know his soul rest? Or have you rested from your own self-righteous works in order to rest in Jesus' work at the cross? Or, believer, are you still passionately pursuing the